Damon. That's triple the entertainment for one ticket, and all proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's La Contessa and Friends live on stage Thursday, February 13th, starting at 7 p.m. Tickets on sale now at brownpapertickets.com. Just search for KBOO. See you there.
It's 9:02. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And coming right up this morning, it's Veterans Voice. Today, join Arlene, Bill, and Marvin as they interview Gulf War veterans Ian LaVallee and Angie Hines. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a 35-year veteran of the NSA speaks out about the Snowden revelations. And an interview with whistleblower Colleen Rowley about the NSA's subversion of democracy. At 11 o'clock on Radio EcoShock, these stories, Breakthrough Science Shows the World Heading Over Climate Cliff, Arnie Gunderson with commentary on fake alarm over California beaches, how can we detox from the toxic chemicals in our environment, and a look at how these suburbs are killing the climate. Thanks to all you KBOO members for your great support. If you're not a member, you can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Do it today. That would be great. Okay, Veterans Voice coming up next.
Baghdad, dancers of death, murder in the air with the next breath. Macho queens selling war makers' toys, raining destruction, good old boys. Deathbringer in Queen George's eyes, read his lips, war maker lies. Religious Reich's revenging sword, thou shalt kill in the name of the Lord. The sheep and the cattle can't keep from milling. Some are more than ready, some aren't willing. Volunteering in what they're not dying for. The young Republican Guard crying for war. Free speech, as free as it's thought. Controlled behavior reacts as it's taught. Fighting for peace, can't comprehend. Hate out of love is violent pretend.
Bombs over Baghdad. Bombs over Baghdad. Bombs over Baghdad. Bombs over Baghdad.
Vampires drinking blood and oil cocktails. Their violence works, it hardly ever fails. When blind man can't see, he believes blind. Blind obedience is the child of mindless mind. New world order is an old world lie. Fighting for peace, see how they die. Dragging in God as they turn violent. God says nothing, he just remains silent. Stop madmen from running loose. Mother Earth woman can't take the abuse. Living right now is living for tomorrow. Time is saying there's no more time to borrow. Vampires drinking blood and oil cocktails. Their violence works. It hardly ever fails.
Bombs over Baghdad.
Dancers of death.
Murder in the air. With the next breath. Macho queens selling war makers' toys. Raining destruction. Good old boys. New world order. It's a whole world line.
Baghdad, dancers of death.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, and 100.7 FM Albany, Corvallis, and Eugene, and also on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. I'm Marvin, along with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
And Arlene.
Hi, good morning.
Today we're going to be talking with Angie Hines and Ian Lavallee, who are both Gulf War veterans, Bill and I had a good friend die, Anthony Grusko.
Yeah.
And Anthony was a longtime peace veteran. He was also an atomic veteran, and he was a big, important part of the veterans' peace movement early on.
He was in a movie or a documentary that was made called.
Atomic something.
Atomic something, yeah. It's about the atomic veterans.
It slips by.
Sorry. It's
all right, we'll get it.
Radio Bikini.
Yeah, Radio Bikini, because he was at Bikini. He was at Bikini during that. And he was also a big part of the Nevada test site protest down at north of Las Vegas.
And he spent many hours in Japan, and the Japanese spent many hours over here commiserating about the death that we rained on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
What was this gentleman's name again? I'm sorry.
Anthony Grusko. Okay. Anthony Grusko. And just a great guy. And he's been sick for a long time. And it's a great loss to the veterans movement. But he was a wonderful man, wonderful man. We're going to miss him a lot.
Yes.
Miss him a lot. And coming up real soon here at the end of January is Tet. It's going to be the Tet celebration. 46 years ago, January 30th, 1968, the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, and North Vietnamese attacked every major city in South Vietnam, took over the American embassy, and changed the war. They may have lost a lot of their men, but they changed the minds of the American people and changed the war. And so, remember that? We were there, weren't we?
Oh, God, yes, I sure
Arlene and I were both there at that time. And there's one book I want to tell you folks about. It's by Penny Lewis. It's called Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks, The Vietnam Anti-War Movement and as Myth and Memory. And I'm going to try and get her, interview her in a couple months. And that's really going to be a good book. And let's get started. Good. Arlene, you want to go ahead and introduce everybody?
Yes, yes. It's nice and it's an honor to have both of you here. Yeah. Angie Hines, who served, why don't you tell us?
I served in the United States Navy from 2001 to 2005 on the USS Calpins, which was deployed to Iraq, which fired the first ordnance to initiate Operation Iraqi Freedom, mm-hmm. and was also considered Air Defense Commander, and was involved in looking over 150 different ships' operations, and was assigned to the USS Kitty Hawk Strike Group.
Strike Group there. Thank you.
And what was your job?
I was an operations specialist, which means I was an air radar operator, and I tracked air contacts in the sky and everything that flew. I needed to know what it was and what it was doing, keeping things out of the no-fly zone.
Okay.
Thank you, Angie. And Ian. Ian, go introduce yourself, please.
Sure. I served from 14 March 2005 until 19 December 2006. I was an airborne infantryman in Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 325th Airborne Infantry Regiment. I'm part of the 2nd Brigade Combat Team of the 82nd Airborne. And I was in Iraq from the very beginning of September to the end of December of 2005 in Talifar, which is in northwestern Iraq, about equidistant from the Syrian and the Turkish borders.
Wonderful. It's so good to have you both here.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that has come to my mind is I wanted to hear what you want to say.
Yeah.
What we need to hear from you And how? What is it that you want to say to our listeners and to the public out there? What should we know?
Yeah, I'd like to know how you got involved in the Veterans Peace Movement.
That transformation must have taken place, and how you juxtapose that with your role in the military, if you want to get into that.
Sure.
Either of you, or both.
Well, I would say during my time in the military and in Iraq, especially my time in Iraq, where we were occupying buildings in a city and basically militarily dominating, mostly with foot patrols, but also with vehicles and support of armor from the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. And during those experiences, I started seeing a lot of, I guess, you know, extremely upsetting things and being a part of some pretty horrible things in my during my time that made me question the validity of us being there and the reasoning for us being there, and feeling that, you know, we weren't doing what we said we were doing. We were just making more enemies for ourselves, for America. Mm-hmm. So we weren't making America safer, because that's what we were said we were doing. And we said we were there to help the people there. But the things that I saw, if people were doing in my community, you know, I would pick up my grandpa's rifle and fight them too. And sure. I saw commonality between, you know, what we talk about, you know, the freedom fighters of the American Revolution and these people who were trying to fight off, you know, they weren't like hardened terrorists from Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda, you know, they were just people who lived there that didn't want a foreign military occupying their homes and, you know, killing their families. And even if it was on accident or on purpose, or no one would want that. And that's a big thing that I would want people to know is that, you know, we were, you know, sometimes we did do good things that I thought were good. And we were helping people by giving them like blankets and mattresses and vitamin fortified milk for their malnourished kids. But then at the same time, we would turn around and do things that, you know, far out overweighed in a negative sense, the positive things that we were doing.
Yeah.
And the way that we treated ourselves as soldiers and each other, you know, didn't assist, you know, our own, you know, health in many ways.
Thanks, Ian. Angie.
I got involved with Veterans for Peace several years ago because it really, and I got out in 2005, like I said, it took me several years first to go through the process of even realizing I was a veteran, and then thinking about how things were actually eating at me and internally that were really bothering me. And to know how much waste was out there, and during my experience, it seemed like a lot of what I did seemed sort of ridiculous. There was a lot of waste. There were so many ammunitions that were used, so many missiles that were fired that we almost blew ourselves up one time because that was a $100,000 missile. Mm-hmm. Because it went over the side of the ship and fell into the water. Mm. And then they just immediately got another okay to fire another. That's $100,000. And just seeing those things, experiencing a lot of harassment in the military, it really made me not able to forget about anything like that.
Yeah.
And I know that other people suffer. It was primarily when I got out. And I had to make the transition of military to civilian. And it was really hard because I came back to the United States after being overseas for
several years.
It was four. Okay.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Well.
You were over there for a while.
Who's counting?
Yeah. I don't know. It's all the same. Yeah. But it really seemed like when I came back, I had a hard time identifying with people. I had a hard time finding my community again. And I'm a very community-based person. I really rely on my friends a lot as my family because I have a really small family. And so it just kept eating at me, all the things that we were doing. We were still wasting all this money while we were cutting other funds in the United States that I knew were more important. Mm. And that bothered me to the point that I just said, well, you know, I'm going to go to this Veterans for Peace meeting. And then I also became a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I would just read literature, try to attend meetings. And I was really pleased to know that there were actually other, a lot of other people out there who felt like I did, that I'm not anti-military personnel. I'm not anti-veteran. I'm very pro-troop.
Of course, yes.
But I am anti-war at the core of it. And all of the money and spending and disaster, environmental degradation and human loss that happens was absolutely driving me nuts. And so that's how I ended up getting involved in the peace movement.
Great. Thank you, Marvin.
Yeah. I was just wondering, like, what was the, like, Ian, I'm going to start with you on this one. What was the, for me in Vietnam, I knew as soon as something happened that this was bad, you know, that this whole thing was just completely stupid. Was there, like, one certain thing, or was it just everything hit you at one time, or was it just one thing?
I think it was cumulative because I really wanted to believe in the good that we could do with our military. It was something that I believed in since I was a child, and that what we're taught, you know, I always felt very strongly about that, even though my family was, you know, rather liberal and like, but they still believed in, you know, military being used sometimes. My mother was in the Navy for 5 years. My grandfather was in the Navy in World War II. My uncle served in the Army during Vietnam. It wasn't a, my stepmother's, you know, grandfather was an FBI agent. Like, there's all these different things that pointed to those things being honorable. And I guess when that started being eroded by my experiences of in Iraq and just in the military in general, it just, it took some time. And I also joined VFP and IVAW about 6 or 7 months after I got out of the military.
Wow, real fast.
Real fast.
Yeah, I was introduced by, because I was getting involved with some different activists because I felt like I needed to be doing something with purpose still, but that actually was doing some good instead of, you know, what we were doing in the military. And through those activists, I met some people who were a part of IVAW.
Yeah, so IVAW is really important, I think. And
it's Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Iraq Veterans Against the War, they're really good. How about you, Angie? Was there a certain thing that got you to go anti-war? Or was it just like Ian, or just a bunch of things?
I was pretty much always anti-war. I never really believed in war. I actually joined, I left in November 2001, but I was in the delayed entry program since August, so I actually signed up before September 11th.
Oh.
And I thought that I was just going to, it was going to be an easy free ride in the Navy. Just
see the
touring
world.
The world, right. Getting my college money.
Were you going to go to school?
I was planning on going
was
to school.
That was one of your intentions?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to do that. I wasn't really nationalistic or anything. And so when September 11th happened, I went back to my recruiter and I said, hey, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
This is kind of serious. And he goes, oh, no. Oh, there's nothing going on. And then I was deployed. And then I went straight over there.
Anchors away.
Yeah. And so they shut off our email. They told us that if we told any of our family members where we were going, it was going to compromise operational security or OPSEC. And so for over 3 months, I wasn't able to tell anybody where I was, and I wasn't able to talk to anybody. No incoming emails, okay. So you could hear your family screaming on the other
end.
Where
are you? What's
where
going
are you?
On?
But you can't answer them.
Mm.
So I never really liked the idea of war, but it was funny because there weren't any real gung-ho people on my ship. It wasn't like everybody was all pumped and ready to go. I think people were actually kind of nervous and scared. There wasn't any crazy racist talk against terrorists. No, there wasn't anything like that. I think people were just really nervous because they were telling us about all these different threats that could potentially kill us and everything. Uh-huh. I think everybody was just trying to make sure that we didn't die.
Mm. Oh, my.
Yeah. And or something like the USS Cole wouldn't happen to us because that was a major threat, a small boat attack or a chemical bomb or a mine.
Ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were just trying to watch out for that.
Wow. That's interesting. Go ahead, Bill.
A question I'd like to ask both of you. How was the attitude towards the people that you served with? You mentioned it, Angie. But I'm curious as to how the guys felt there, who you served with, and how you got along with your fellow soldiers or military.
Especially, I'd like to know the feelings, the men and the women. That you know what I'm saying.
During my deployment, in general. Yeah.
Well, we'll get to general later, but during your employment.
You know, during deployment, it was just long, very long days, lots and lots of drills. Everybody was pretty much being ground to the bone. I was only getting maybe 4 hours of sleep a night, sometimes staying up for over 24 hours because I already had watch for technically 12 hours a day, but then we'd have to do other things, so I was working about 17 hours a day, and drills on top of those, and
you were sleep deprived.
Very sleep deprived. I was totally jacked up on Notos the whole time, which had ephedrine at the time, which I was just—I don't know how I didn't have a heart attack.
Yeah.
But the attitude was basically everybody was just kind of like a drone doing their job and just. Face down, trying to look at the ground ahead of you and just take one step in front of the next and just get through the day. It was pretty emotionless. There wasn't a whole lot of excitement.
Was there any news aboard the ship that would be contradictory to what the job that you were doing? I'm not saying it very well.
I understand what you mean, I think. Well, there was a... Because we were Air Defense Commander, we listened to another frequency, which had the ground troops on it, which I could hear people getting shot at and killed. I heard somebody say something about they saw women and children waving flags, and what should they do? And they were ordered to shoot them. And so I heard things like that, and it really didn't feel very good.
No,
but
of course not.
What was I supposed to do? I was newly in the military and didn't have any power whatsoever. And
you were on a ship.
I felt completely powerless and like I was unable to do anything. Yeah. But yes, I did hear some things like that, and then they started doing these drills that were... I had a secret security clearance, so I usually knew everything that was going to be going on with the daily routine on the ship. I knew where the ship was going and what it was going to be doing, and I knew all the drills that were coming. And then they started doing these surprise drills that basically... I thought I was going to die, and everybody thought they were going to die from a chemical attack because nobody knew that they were fake, and our gas masks didn't have seals on them.
So they put a lot of fear into you.
So I figured that I was just going to be...
How about you, Ian?
Yeah.
Was there any, like news from, like, other...
How about the fellows that you served with, your company?
Like, how did they feel about
being
there?
Yeah.
How was that going on?
When I was in, we used to go through a series called Troop Information and Education, TIE.
Hmm.
Did you have that kind of...
About, like, regiment? What we were going to be doing
why
we were doing it?
Uh-huh.
We had... some of those that kind of stuff going on before we went. And I mean, I was going on the third deployment of my battalion. They had been in the invasion and then another 6 months, and then this was another 4 month stint. And so the guys that I went with, most of them had already been once or twice. And so some of them, you know, it was the infantry. We were the airborne infantry. You know, we're supposed to be gung-ho. It's real macho. It's real, you know, we're going to take it to the enemy. You know, we're going to close with and destroy the enemy. That's the infantry's job. And people were pumped about it to a degree. And there wasn't much talk about, like, against what we were doing, or, like, people didn't bring that up. Or, you know, if you brought that up, the people would be like, no politics, no religion, you know. Or they would, you know, if you started criticizing something, then, you know, you'd be shut down immediately this way or that way. But one thing that does stick out to me is I remember before we went, just as we were, like, getting ready to go overseas, one of the guys that I was with, he had been and gone on both of those deployments and lost close friends on those deployments. And he, you know, he said, well, he was just, he didn't care about the people in Iraq at all at that point. You know, he's was just thought they were just like worthless. I don't care about them. I don't care about this mission. Mm-hmm. My friends were not worth this. Mm. Yeah. And for me, like, not being there yet, haven't been there. And I said, well, you know, even though I signed up not thinking that the Iraq war was the right war, we should have continued to fight the war in Afghanistan at the time. That's what I believed. But that we were in Iraq and that we had to, like, fall through with what we had started, or it would be in a worse place. But, like, hearing things like that, which was few and far in between, really, like, stuck with me about, wow, that's, you know, that's really real. You know, this guy's been there twice and he's lost mm-hmm. friends and, you know, mm-hmm. he's engaged in combat and he's saying this isn't worth it.
Wow.
And he's so despondent that he's, like, you know, not even caring about how we're treating the Iraqis there.
The Iraqi civilians.
Yeah. And
how are the two of you responding to what's happened in Fallujah lately? Or do you follow the news? How does that feel? Go ahead, Ian.
I mean, we destabilized the region by our invasion, you know, by the haphazard invasion and occupation. We really shifted the power center to Iran, and it made it so that the war that's going on in Iraq now is just a continuation of what we started in 91,
yeah.
you know. Yeah. Or you can say it even started before that, because we were giving Saddam money and weapons for a long time.
And military assistance.
Yeah, for a very long time, yeah. even before the Iran-Iraq war.
Right.
You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And today we're talking with Angie Hines and Ian Lavallee about their experience in the Gulf and their time in the military. And pretty interesting. And I'd like to get back to Ian as being an infantryman also. I was an infantryman also. And I was just wondering, when you guys were just sitting around talking, which you didn't do much because we didn't, what was it? Were you talking about what you were doing? Was anybody starting to question it?
Not really at all. Like, not really. Those kind of conversations weren't kind of allowed within the group of people. Like, everyone kind of self-censored, and I think where people were afraid to, and when people tried to talk about politics or religion, it was kind of like shut down, like in a jovial.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, like I remember doing things like they were feeding pork food, MREs, meals ready to eat to some of the detainees that we had in the school building we occupied. And I remember, like, talking to a friend of mine and be like, hey man, that's, like, messed up, we shouldn't, you know, do that. And he, you know, he's like, I don't effing care, you know. Just like little things like that, that it was hard to even broach the subject, or it's scary to talk about, because, you know, we were under mortar or rocket fire and small arms fire and fear of IEDs, like, constantly. And to think about trying to speak out against whatever our mission was, or to say this is messed up, you know, people are already trying to kill you. You don't want to turn the people who are your only lifeline to against you, or make them.
Of course.
And yeah, so discussion didn't really. Tried not to go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. Amazing. I'd like to talk to Angie again about, we were talking a little bit about your time on the ship, but I want to talk a little bit about your time when you first went into the military, into the Navy, about how you were treated as a woman.
Oh, boy, that's a topic for another program, isn't it?
Yeah. I was pretty excited to be in the Navy. I was like I said, I was never gung-ho, nationalist, pro-war or anything, but I was excited to be on a ship. When I first walked up to my ship, I thought, wow, look at all these guns. This is amazing.
How old were you?
I was 19. I was just a kid.
Just a kid, yeah.
And so when you first arrive at your command, you're given a paper where you have to check in with your chain of command.
Go ahead.
And so I had this paper, and I ended up going around to my chain of command. I checked in with my LPO, my leading petty officer, and he grabs a paper out of my hand, and he signs it, and he doesn't look me in the eye. He doesn't even turn his head, and he goes, "Get pregnant and get out of here."
Oh.
That's the first thing you got.
That's pretty much the first. That was my first day.
Welcome
aboard.
Get pregnant and get out of here.
Yeah. So it was really hard because the boat I was on, the USS Cowpens, is a guided missile cruiser. It is approximately 350 people, 40 women at tops.
Wow.
So it was very apparent when something was going on with me or with another female. If I either wasn't doing something right or something, it was really obvious. I was able to stand out tremendously. And so I would say that it was really nerve-wracking. And I actually don't really recommend that women join the military. I don't think it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
You're 15 times more likely to be raped by a comrade than killed in combat.
Mm-hmm. Or set up to fail, whatever.
Or anything like that.
Yes.
And so it was a very difficult situation that I still have a lot of stress from now.
Mm-hmm. Of course. I understand that.
Yeah. So it was not easy.
Thank you for your honesty.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But was there any harassment of the same kind when you were deployed?
When I was deployed, like I said, it was almost like everybody was completely shut down and just doing the absolute one thing after the next.
Working,
eating, sometimes sleeping, and just trying to make sure that nothing hit our ship, and just trying to keep the airspace clear and things like that. And that alone was enough because small boats were coming at us, and we did have to call out to them all the time. And so we're just trying to pretty much focus on what we're doing at the time. I didn't really notice a whole lot about that. It did accumulate, though, over the years. Situations accumulated to where I started understanding more and more about how drastically unequal things are and how different I was treated than others.
Yeah, it had to be tough. That had to be tough.
And I'm not an anti-male person.
Right.
No.
So it's just a fact. It's just that's really the way it is. It's really hard. And people don't understand a lot of times that you can't handle sexual harassment or assault or anything like that in the military like you do in the civilian world, because you don't go to a chaplain and say, "Chaplain,
something happened
to me." No, you go to disciplinary review board and DRB, as they call it, and you stand in at attention in the chief's mess, which is a senior enlisted person in the Navy, and at attention, you're not supposed to look them in the eye, and it's all men, and you're supposed to explain what you did, and a Disciplinary Review Board goes in your record as an action against you.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. That's...
And nothing ever happens anyway. It's other females on the ship two times in the times that I was there, they brought up incidents, and neither time anything happened, even when one of the people actually had two other previous attacks on his record from two previous commands, and mm-hmm. still nothing happened. So there's really no point. You get in trouble. Your qualifications are pulled. You're set to sweep the deck and chip paint. And
sounds like you're silenced.
They're told you're ordered. I was ordered not to talk to one of my friends, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's under the dictates of the UCMJ?
The Disciplinary Review Board part of it is, uh-huh. as far as that handling of it. But the isolation and shunning is something that is more of a cultural thing uh-huh. in the military.
Yeah.
You explain that very well.
Yeah, that was...
I've thought about it a lot.
I bet you have. I'll bet you have. I'll bet you have.
Man. Oh, man.
How do you feel about what's happening? I asked you that a little bit earlier about, like, in Fallujah.
I guess I kind of digressed off of
that. Yeah, go ahead,
Ian. Yeah.
You're on, buddy.
How does that resonate with you now?
It wasn't our city in the first place. We should have never been there in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, even if, let's say, like, hypothetically, the invasion happened, you know, the Iraqi army turned itself in, was like, their commanders were saying, what should we do with these brigades and battalions? And our government told, you know, disbanded the military and put all these men out of work
yeah.
who knew where all the weapons were, who knew how to use them.
And took them home with them.
Yeah. Well, they'd been, you know, they were cached all over the country. And then they started seeing what was happening to their country under the Americans. They thought the Americans were going to come and do the right thing. And, you know, I have friends who told me who are officers who, you know, they had, you know, colonels and generals come to them and be like, what do you want us to do with our men? Like, they surrendered their brigades, you know, and they told them they all go home. You know, they could have controlled the country. Like, we could have done so much more to help those people, but we didn't, you know, because of the top down of what's mm-hmm. going on.
Isn't that where we were shown the picture of the two people hanging from the bridge?
Yeah, I believe it was four contractors.
Yeah, contractors. Yeah.
But uh-huh. I think some of them had served in the military.
Uh-huh.
And that was supposed to be the impetus for what we did there. I mean,
right.
what's going
right.
on in Fallujah now, beyond the fighting that's going on between the Sunni and the Shia-led yeah. government that's backed by Iran, and the destabilization from what's coming in from Syria. Like, I guess I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all.
Do you believe that some of this action, if I hear you right, is backed by Iran?
Well, Maliki, the president of Iraq, he was in exile in Iran while Saddam was in.
Okay.
And he's a Shia. And if you look into it now, a lot of the military is dominated by the Shia Arab sect. And that's the like about 60% of the population in Iraq is Shia, whereas Saddam had been Sunni.
Right.
And since the invasion, you know, we really divided and conquered in that sense by pushing communities and marriages and people that were much more homogenous in the sense of not relating to one another as Sunni and Shia mm-hmm. in such a decisive way, to creating what is, you know, to fomenting what is going on now. And not to mention just all the effects of chemical and DU munitions. And how depleted uranium, and how that's affecting the people of Fallujah, especially, but in many other places in Iraq, and the rates of, you know, malformed and deformed children, and
really
just horrible things that are going on because of the munitions we used there.
Yeah. Did you guys use white phosphorus?
I never saw the use of white phosphorus.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, never did. But I mean. To me, it's like, what does it matter if someone's being killed by gas or by a bullet or a bomb or like a rocket or whatever? What's the difference? You know,
same. You're dead.
You know, it's like, oh, that's worse because you know the death might be, I mean, more agonizing, or you can kill more people a little bit more indiscriminately. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know.
Did you guys have a rules of engagement?
Definitely. But I remember this talk that we got, all the new guys that we got to our unit from the replacement. We got to our unit at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And we were taken aside after this briefing about the deployment. We were going to have the whole battalion briefing, like in a stadium kind of thing. And then he took a whole bunch, a very senior NCO, took a group of us who had just gotten to the unit. And he basically said, you know, you do whatever you have to do to bring everybody home.
Mm.
And so I respect that, but at the same time, you know, we basically, you know, here and there learned more and more that, you know, if we had to shoot somebody because we thought they were a threat, and we find out that they weren't a threat, mm-hmm. afterwards, things were going to be okay.
Yeah, you weren't going to get in trouble for it.
Weren't going to get in trouble.
And, right. So that happened a lot. How about your guys? Like, we had, in my unit, we had guys that were just cold-blooded killers. I mean, they were cold-blooded killers. They didn't give a heck about anything. They were cold-blooded killers. And did you guys have anybody like that?
I didn't meet anyone who was outwardly like that. I never had friends who were like, oh, you know, I just want to
kill somebody.
And when somebody did say that, people who were more senior usually were like, you know, you need to shut up.
Oh, good,
because
good.
That's just stupid.
Yeah, that's good.
And the guys that I knew who did shoot people, you know, they didn't walk around bragging about it. Mm-hmm. It's not something they were happy to do. You know, if you mm-hmm. ask them about an incident, they'd tell you, yeah, oh, I shot that guy. And then, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of the run of the mill.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anyone there, you know, wouldn't have killed if they thought it was needed. But I feel like maybe because my unit had been there on the first two deployments, they were pretty controlled. Mm-hmm. Like when we were fired upon and we couldn't find out where we were being fired upon from, we wouldn't just engage, you know, and willy-nilly, you know.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it was really good in that sense.
So were you guys just straight leg?
We were airborne, so we were on our. We had I think two Humvees per platoon of about 40 mm-hmm. guys. So we were 90% of the time on foot, mm-hmm. Night and day patrols, mm-hmm. living in an occupied school building in the neighborhood that we lived in.
Mm-hmm.
We probably had like a square mile or so, maybe a little bit less of area that my company covered, and we would switch off between patrol, guarding, and quick reaction force,
mm-hmm.
And. Yeah, so we were just on our feet all the time doing night and day patrols.
So what was how was the reaction between the grunts and just the everyday people, and specifically the children? I mean,
sometimes we'd give them candy, and other times, you know, we'd put explosives on their door at 2 a.m. and blow the door in, mm-hmm. and then wake them up with a gun barrel and a flashlight in their face,
right.
yelling at them in a language that they didn't understand. Separating the women and the children to one room, the, you know, teenage and up men in another place, zip tie them, take all of them. God, they don't know where they're going. You know, their family, the women and children don't know where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I pointed my weapon more times than I can even count or imagine at children because they weren't doing what we wanted them to do.
Yeah, they can't understand English.
Yeah, and or they'd come around and they'd be like, oh, look at these, and we'd give them candy sometimes.
Yeah, and then next time.
Or a water bottle, right. Or an MRE, or sometimes we'd throw water bottles at them, you know, mm-hmm. from the trucks and try to hit them. Or,
right.
But,
did you have an interpreter?
We had, like, maybe one or two interpreters for the company.
Really?
Yeah.
Boy, that's not very good, is it?
No.
Wow.
Did you feel that... the military, our military, was, well, I suppose you did, dehumanizing the enemy.
Oh,
I mean, they weren't human.
Before
right?
we went, you know, we were told about the rules of engagement and, or how about like, you know, if that we would give medical, treatment to anybody that we, right. you know, an enemy combatant, but, you know, we might just like wait a little while to uh-huh. give him treatment. You know, we'd right. get our guys taken care of and then just let him rest for a little bit, you know, that kind of. Like attitude. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
I don't remember what it was. I wanted to ask you, Angie, you knew or did you know what your missiles were doing?
I had no idea.
You didn't?
No.
Not then, but you do now.
I have an idea, and I still don't really know. I've tried to figure it out. What some of the people on my ship said, some of the senior officers said that we shot one of Saddam's palaces, and that's all I know. I have no idea where the missiles went. I have no idea where they went.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's not what I meant.
Oh, okay.
What the results of your missiling was doing.
The results?
Yeah. I mean, did you think about the damage and the death?
I definitely thought about that. It was really, really eerie and strange because we would only fire at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and it shook the whole ship really, really hard. And I was thankful that I was able to know when we were actually doing this because of my clearance. But other people on the ship didn't even know that we were going to be shooting anything. Hmm. And this would literally shake the whole ship at 3 o'clock in the morning. And
so what was it doing where it landed?
Yeah,
no idea. Yeah, I had no idea what happened. I don't know who I killed or what happened or mm-hmm. what it blew up or anything. I never heard any results mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. No idea.
Did you have anything to do with the targeting? Did they set these targets just immediately before shooting or firing, I mean? And
I think that they probably had some kind of, they probably knew where they were going to be shooting, but it was the fire controlman who would actually shoot, which was in the same radar room as where I worked. So I could see the missiles flying across the screen because we would put a missile identification thing on it as they were being launched. But then once it gets out of radar range, who knows where it goes? I have no idea.
Yes, like the Nazi says, when they fired V2
rockets.
They didn't know where they were coming down.
That's what Wernher von Braun. Yeah,
he just fired them.
Once the missile goes up, who cares where they come down?
Right, Wernher von Braun. Yeah. So I back to Ian again. When you were getting short time. Like, were you guys worried about being, what they call it, the extended, what they call that?
Extended.
Stop loss.
Stop loss.
Well, stop loss is more about people who are about to get out of the military.
Oh, okay.
And so when they're about to get out, and then they would extend their term of service to get them to, so say, and often it happened to people overseas
mm-hmm.
who were supposed to get out then. I know people who were stop loss, a lot of people, but
you were
no my I you know I joined in March of 2005 and mm-hmm. I went to Iraq in September and
wow.
So I had years ahead of my deployment.
So you were in for 3 years?
No, I initially signed up for 4 years and 19 weeks and then 19 weeks included the training one station unit training
mm-hmm.
and then when I returned from Iraq about 4 months coming back, I had been developing symptoms of PTSD.
Sure.
And I reached a point where I thought my best course of action would be to end my life.
Oh,
and
baby.
So I attempted suicide. And that led to a recommendation of discharge, an honorable discharge, because my conduct had been honorable.
Mm-hmm.
And that they recognized that I had a medical condition
mm-hmm.
and related to my service. And so they recommended that I get out, but that led to 9 months of what I would call purgatory. And then I eventually was discharged honorably in December of 2006. So
2006.
I only served, just under two years.
Mm-hmm. But let's get back to this.
Stop loss.
No, I want to get back to the suicide stuff, because I just read an article that the suicide rate in the veterans now, especially the younger veterans, I think they were saying 19 to 22 or something, is really high. It's gone up. And women, too. I mean, women, the suicide rate in women is gone up like 11%. Do you guys know, do you both know anybody that's
well,
been?
I know. I don't know. None of my veteran friends have committed suicide, but when I was in the military, there were suicides.
On the active duty?
Active
yes.
duty? On your ship?
There were two on my ship. There was one guy, he jumped off the main mast, splattered on the pier. There was another guy that hung himself, but somebody else found him and cut him down. So he didn't actually die, but it was an attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And then one morning I was raising the flag for colors, and on the other side of the pier, the other ship, somebody on watch shot themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it is 22 a day, and it's definitely a day. It's rising, and it's hard to.
And now we're talking about, you know, going to war with Iran and Syria, and we're putting troops in Somalia.
Yeah,
I don't understand it.
Insane.
It makes me very angry.
And Australia.
Yeah, we got troops in Australia. Ian, how about the infantry units? Were there any problems there?
There were many suicide attempts in my unit when we were stateside.
Stateside?
Yeah, when we were stateside after the deployment. When I was in Iraq, I don't remember hearing about suicides or suicide attempts in my unit. But when I got back, you know, mine was not the only one in our battalion, let alone the division.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were a lot of, you know, what could have been vehicular suicides.
Right.
But we'll never know because they're dead and nobody left a note. But there were often motor vehicle suicides or like motorcycle suicides.
Yeah.
That I believe that a lot of
those
were.
Oh, I do too.
Because people would get completely hammered or get on like a really high amount of drugs and drive down a 30-mile-an-hour road going 90 and wrap themselves around a street lamp.
Yeah, it's also important to note the massive amount of self-mutilation that actually goes on. A lot of self-cutters, burners, and people who get absolutely belligerently wasted, blacked out, drunk just to forget their life. And I was one of those people, as is a lot of other people
in the
military.
Infantry.
And just people
drink so much.
Drink to forget your life, drink to
That's
erase
right.
your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a really bad self-mutilator too. It was chronic. I had to retrain my brain when I got out how to deal with stress, how not to be an alcoholic, and how not to cut myself every time I got upset.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually amazingly common. You'll find people with scars like that.
Sure.
See, I've never heard that. Have you, Arlene? Had you heard about that?
Self-mutilation.
Yeah.
I've seen actually quite a bit of it
in Vietnam.
No, not here. In Vietnam, but afterwards.
After,
sure.
Billy, do you hear anything about that?
Oh, in Korea they had a saying that if you got shot below the knee, you were in trouble.
Oh, they thought it was...
Because the guys would shoot their toes off and,
to get out.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, you've brought up so many wonderful... Not wonderful. I didn't mean it that way.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Far-reaching topics and subjects.
Yeah, we only have a few minutes left. Ian, you want to sum up anything you want to say before we go?
I guess... For me, it's really about, you know, do unto others as you would have done unto you. And and after my experience, you know, even though I didn't believe in the war in Iraq, I was like, well, we got to follow through and do it. Well, when I got there and seeing all those things, like I said before, if people were doing what we were doing in Iraq, in our communities here, no matter what their good intentions or stated intentions were, you know, every red-blooded American, if you want to say, you know, would pick up their grandpa's rifle or their M4 or their SIG, and they would start doing what they needed to do to protect their communities. And that's what people overseas are doing. Nobody wants a military occupation and war in their place on somebody else's term.
Right.
People should have self-determination. The people here, I mean, people here are at war with the police, with trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And the systems that we have in place now are not helping people, you know, live good lives. They're enslaving people.
Yeah. How about you, Andy? You got any final words?
Because
what you told me about self-mutilation, I'm going to check on that.
It's something to know about. It's really something to be aware about.
Yeah.
But I would hope that people would think about where they're putting their energy, because we're actually funding everything that's going on here. We've already spent $2 trillion on the war. It's projected by 2050, we'll be spending $6 trillion on this. We've already spent $60 billion to rebuild Iraq, which only has power on and off 3 hours on, 3 hours off a day.
Mm-hmm.
And with all kinds of environmental degradation of depleted uranium, which is affecting them, the Iraqi civilians and also our soldiers, because it travels through the air.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And that's a million times more potent in vitro. So it's a good possibility that we could start seeing some of these things happen. And I would hope that people would get hip to speaking out about yes. things like this. Maybe write your congressman. Maybe yes. call them. Yes. Call yes. the senator's office. Tell them that you don't want to be spending your money on this, because we can't afford it. We really cannot afford to keep doing this.
Yeah, we can't. I want to thank you two for coming down. I wish we had more time. And I want to thank the listeners for listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show here on KBOO 90.7 FM. We'll be back at 9 a.m. on February 21st. And our guest is going to be Vietnam veteran and author Don Blackburn. He's written a really great poem. I have a book for you. I didn't bring it today, but I'll get it to you. He has a wonderful book about his experience in Vietnam, but mostly after the war. He already wrote a book about the war. Now it's after the war.
Yeah.
And he'll be here. And Bill, thanks for coming.
You betcha.
Arlene, thanks for coming.
Thank you. And I'd like to just take a moment to really graciously thank two of you, Ian and Angie. It's been an honor and a privilege.
It's been great.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I really appreciated your honesty and forthrightness and your courage.
Yep.
Your courage to speak out.
I really encourage other vets to speak out and stand up for their rights.
Thank you. Yep.
And to get your benefits.
Yep. And
yes.
Tammy?
Yes, indeed.
Tammy, there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, the young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was...
And this is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 10:01 a.m., coming up, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, and at 11 on Radio EcoShock, we'll hear from Arnie Gunderson and how we can detox from toxic chemicals in our environment. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. And if you're not a current member, go to kboo.fm, click on Donate Today. Stay tuned.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, January 17th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Well, today, lot going on. It's Friday. It's the end of the week. In other nations, this is usually a good day for huge demonstrations. And we haven't seen many of those in recent months in Portland, nonetheless. Before we get to the headlines, just a heads up for listeners. We are very fortunate this morning to be, we'll be speaking with Michael Copps. He is with Common Cause. We're going to be continuing our discussion of net neutrality, the demise of which, and the impact that that is going to have on what we laughingly call American-style democracy. First, though, a few headlines. Jason Conger is a Republican of Bend, and he is, of course, calling for the state shutdown, cover Oregon, and offer subsidies for consumers outside the exchange. But Director Bruce Goldberg said that many of the errors that have kept the website down were eliminated in the past week. I guess better late than never. And advocates cited a statistic that Americans are about 270 times, that's 270 times more likely to die in a workplace accident than in an act of terrorism. Closer communications between government agencies could have prevented the chemical spill from West Virginia from infecting the water supply. Complying with a 1986 federal law, Freedom Industries filed a form in February of 2013 letting local and state officials know that the company was storing a potentially harmful chemical. But, but regulators did not use the information to develop a response plan in the event of